Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, an executive shakeup at JEA. Weeks after the former CEO of JEA is convicted of corruption, his successor announces he's leaving the city-owned utility. Columnist Nate Monroe is here to clue us in on the latest. Later in the program, how you can participate in the 54th annual Earth Day on April 22nd. This year's theme, the planet versus plastics. But first, I'm joined by the man who knows all when it comes to JEA, Nate Monroe, Metro columnist at the Florida Times Union. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Ann.
So a lot has happened in the past week at JEA. Never a dull moment.
Here we are back again.
All right. So let's start with the departure of the current CEO, Jay Stowe. The news of this really just broke Friday of this, right?
Yeah. I mean, this became an incredibly fast-moving story. I had sort of been in trial mode for much of this year and, frankly, had not covered JEA, like the sort of day in, day out kind of things happening there as a beat in quite a while. And so, I was aware of some of the rumblings and a kind of sense of discontent between the board and Jay Stowe for a while. I think there were I think it was fairly clear as of like the fall of last year that there was some tension building. But I almost got the sense that JEA tried to really keep the peace during the trial. And once that was over, it kind of felt like the dam broke and we just arrived here very quickly.
It was funny because during that trial, they, bookended their presentation, prosecutors did, with the former CEO, Paul McElroy, and then kind of wrapped up with Jay Stowe and, presented this as a package. And I guess it would have been awkward at the time if, Stowe was having an open, fight or disagreement with the board. But if this was happening for so long, it's kind of surprising that it seemed to catch everybody a little flat-footed. That the board had to schedule this emergency meeting on Monday, after the Friday when the news broke.
Yeah. I mean, I think this was kind of a gradual building of gripes between the board and the CEO. And I think, this is a little bit speculative on my part, but I think that there was a little bit of a shakeup in the management team that Jay had put together. In his top executive team. And I kind of feel like, one of the issues that I think was going on here was the board felt like Jay was keeping them out of the loop on things. And I think in turn, Jay Stowe believed that the board was trying to micromanage aspects of his job. One of those things was the composition of his management team. One of those highly paid executives working under him, he had allowed to live out of state. And was very fond of in terms of like her abilities, thought she was doing a good job. And this became a source of contention for the board. That executive ended up resigning. And I think that was kind of the impetus for this, like, hey, like this relationship is not working.
And so the executive that resigned, Laura Dutton, she'd been a chief strategy officer at JEA, and she had been in the headlines prior to Jay Stowe's departure because she had been living out of state, as you say, had also just received like a $73,000 a year raise, taking her to close to $400,000 a year. And she was one of four executives making well over $200,000 a year who don't live here, including, oddly, one of them, the position is the VP of People and Culture. It seems like hard to be the vice president of People and Culture at an agency where you're not really there amid the people or the culture. So that series of headlines about the executive pay and people living out of the area really did create, I guess, a headache for him.
It was definitely a headache. I mean, but, again, like none of this was stuff that on its own would it kind of ordinarily lead to, the ouster of a CEO. Every CEO of JEA is going to have stuff like this. It's that organization is too big. It's too full of money. It's too full of personalities and people to avoid any controversy when you're a CEO. And some of the stuff that kind of appeared in the media. I mean, some of these stories seem to me like the kind of routine stuff that you cover when you cover JEA. It didn't seem like you know, these were pretty, you know, kind of normal controversies that you'd see in JEA. This wasn't like the kind of crazy stuff we saw, you know, a couple of years ago.
So there's the aspect of their former CEO going through this criminal procedure, but also big picture, there's just been a number of leadership changes of the agency. They've now changed their CEO 7 times in 6 years, including, you know, repeat performances by Paul McElroy. But is that in the industry? Is that unusual to have that many changes in such a short period?
You know, I can't say that every public utility hasn't had some time of like instability, but I think the idea, and certainly what Wall Street likes to see, is stability. And, you know, people who are around for at least 4 or 5 years, the idea that there is like a succession plan in place is something that I think is important. And JEA used to have that. I mean, that was when Paul McElroy was kind of nearing the end of his tenure, there were a number of executives working under him that I think could have plausibly stepped into that role without any real interruption. And part of that's because that was something that Paul had been planning for. The executives that were under him had been at JEA for decades. And one of the unfortunate legacies of the Aaron Zahn tenure is that when Zahn took over, I mean, by the time he was ousted, all those people were gone. They had either resigned or, you know, were fired at some point. And, you know, so Jay Stowe was really starting from scratch. And, you know, I think one of the issues that Jay found, and I think this will be a difficult thing for a kind of permanent successor to deal with, he was starting from scratch, you know, and so he builds a management team, and all of a sudden this management team, there's a sense that, you know, among some within JEA that this is like a team of like interlopers, you know, who are these outsiders that have just come in here? Like, well, how do you avoid doing this when you're starting from scratch, right? I mean, JEA really needs to build that sort of bench of kind of executive talent back up. And I don't mean that the people working there are not talented now. I just mean, you know, again, we went from a time during which like JEA really promoted from within. I mean, its CEOs traditionally were people who had worked their way up to the job, and that's been really interrupted.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Times Union columnist Nate Monroe about the latest shakeup at JEA. You can join our conversation on social media. You can email firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can call us on air at 904-549-2937. I wonder, is this board maybe overcorrecting? I mean, one of the criticisms from the prior board was that they were too disengaged. They weren't paying enough attention. Then here, after this series of headlines about overpaid executives living out of state, do you think that the board's, you know, tendency to get involved, and I think that's always a dynamic between a board and a CEO, micromanaging versus, you know, but do you think that they're maybe feeling like they need to be more involved given the history of the prior board?
That's certainly possible. And I think that, you know, this is a change of choice that JEA is making and that the board is, I think, effectuating. And I think you get one of these, but you don't get like two of these, and certainly not three of these, right? And so I think where the board needs to be cautious here is in whoever they next empower, and of course there is an interim CEO now, and you know, whatever they kind of decide the long-term sort of leadership situation is, they need to be mindful and be thinking about, this needs to be the person that we can live with for 5 years, you know, because that agency needs stability. I mean, as you said, that changeover in CEOs is not good. And I do think from the kind of management class of employees all the way down to the front lines, there is a feeling of instability. And it's scary when the CEO of your company is like constantly somebody else. That's weird.
Which is why you would think that this board would be cognizant of that and perhaps preparing for a less abrupt transition than just occurred. But I wonder, you know, the CEO that is now serving as the interim kind of came out of retirement just very recently and got back involved in JEA. Do you think that the board was trying to cue her up for that transition, maybe in a more orderly fashion, that they just somehow didn't get ahead of.
I mean, that certainly could have been the case. So Vicky Cavey is a longtime JEA employee, started as a mechanical engineer and worked her way up and became a trusted advisor to Paul McElroy. And so I think she's, in my mind at least, and I think others often kind of associate her with like that kind of McElroy era of JEA. And I do think in some ways her appointment as the interim is a little bit of a kind of a throwback, kind of an effort to sort of recapture that time when JEA was really cultivating its own talent and sort of promoting from within. Whether she'll be able to replicate that is something we'll have to see.
Do we know anything about when we'll learn of severance packages? I mean, this Jay Stowe is going to remain roughly till August on kind of an interim advisory consultant basis, but he's out for all intents and purposes, and she's in. Are they going to end up having to pay him out in the same way that they were initially obligated to pay out someone like Aaron Zahn?
I thought that I'm not sure about that. And I'm not saying that JEA did not explain that, but I think that his compensation was something that they'd
previously
talked about.
So let's switch gears if we can. The utility, as we said, just wrapped up this damaging criminal trial. And I wonder how much scar tissue you think was created in that whole disruption with Aaron Zahn, going to court, being charged, now convicted. Is it something that the utility as a whole is damaged by long term? Is it affected, or do you think that they're able to just kind of pick up and move on?
Well, no, I mean, I do think there was long term damage, and some of it is what I just described, which is the complete depletion of institutional knowledge in JEA's executive ranks. I mean, Zahn's elevation as to the CEO job really kind of interrupted, what was a real succession plan. I mean, Paul McElroy had been a kind of a mentor to Melissa Dykes, who was the CFO at the time, and had come up, had kind of a similar trajectory at JEA as Paul had done. And so, I mean, I think there was kind of a succession plan in place. I think there were people around the CEO at the time that again could have stepped into that role. The head of the electric system had been there for a long time and was pretty well respected. I mean, so the depletion of all of that, Zahn either ran them off or brought out their worst qualities and kind of rendered them incapable of leadership. I think that's something that happened to Melissa Dykes, where these people just ended up getting sort of wrapped into the controversies and would get fired later. So, I mean, I think that depletion has had a very significant long-term impact on JEA. And I think it, to some degree, explains why we're seeing what we're seeing now.
So Aaron Zahn, despite being convicted, has now made some filings in that case, asking for an acquittal from the judge or asking to have a new trial. So tell us about those new filings.
Yeah, I mean, we knew that these were coming. And I think this is a not unusual part of the kind of trial process here, that, defendants have a right to ask for a judgment of acquittal, even if a jury has convicted them of crimes. And that's what this is. I think as a general rule, the more extraordinary the ask you're making of a judge, the rarer it is that judges actually grant these kinds of things. And so certainly asking for Judge Brian Davis to acquit Zahn after a unanimous jury verdicts convicted him, I think is probably not going to happen. I think the real kind of interest about these filings is that, and this is something Zahn's legal team has said, this is kind of indicative of what his appeal is going to look like in this case.
And so some of the elements are that they're saying, that the government failed to prove that money belonging to JEA was actually, stolen. And that is, of course, nothing happened. The transaction was not completed because it was disrupted by this whole investigation, and the city pulled the plug. But that's been one of their main things, is like, no harm, no foul. This guy didn't actually walk away with $30 million or $300 million, whatever.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's been their kind of theory of the defense. I think another thing that they raise, they raised it during the trial, they raised it in their filing, is, oh, well, all these things would have had to have happened before Zahn could have gotten the money.
The whiteboard that they laid out, they had this long list of items.
Yeah, they had this long list of things. And, I understand why they're raising that point. I mean, I think just logically, I mean, look, the nature of a conspiracy is if you and I conspire to rob a bank, there's like a whole lot of stuff that has to happen before we're successful in robbing the bank, right? Like, you've got to knock out the security guard. We have to make sure the silent alarm doesn't get tripped. You got to get the guy to open the vault. I mean, these are all things that have to happen. Yeah. So, like, the idea that, yeah, of course things would have had to have happened. I mean, that's like what a conspiracy kind of is. So, some of this stuff is some of these are arguments that Davis has already rejected. And I don't think that he is going to, enter a judgment of acquittal for Aaron Zahn based on this. But I do think some of the arguments they raise might, there is always the possibility that they can find some traction with appeals courts. The bottom line is public corruption is very hard to prosecute. The Supreme Court has made it even harder to prosecute over the last couple of decades. And so that to me is what I really think they're kind of talking to the 11th Circuit at this point.
Yeah. And so what are we expecting to see next? I mean, he has not yet been sentenced. I think that's in June. But what happens once he's sentenced, assuming that he's going to file an appeal? A lot of times defense attorneys will ask for someone to remain free pending that appeal process. What do you anticipate the judge would do in this case? Is he going to allow him to remain free, or would he get some prison time right off?
I mean, I think...
conceivably, he could get no prison time anyway, I guess, depending on what the judge chose to sentence him to.
Right. Yeah, so first we'd have to know what the sentence is. He will probably ask to be able to remain out of prison pending his appeal. I don't think that is a very commonly... I don't think that is something that judges often allow for. That's not something that Corrine Brown, a longtime congresswoman who was in prison and also on trial several years ago, she did not get that chance. And I think for the judge to do that, he would, a little bit like this judgment of acquittal, he would almost have to believe that Zahn had a decent chance of getting these convictions vacated. And I don't know why the judge would think that. This was a trial that he oversaw and helped organize, frankly.
I just want to get to a comment of that we got emailed from Mark. He says, going to keep banging this drum. JEA continues its war on residential rooftop solar and net metering with terms like duck curve or demand curve, because apparently they can't quite figure out when the sun will rise or set, or even when it's cloudy. FPL pays a fair rate for excess solar power, but JEA does not. He says they would rather buy expensive private solar than allow rooftop solar. And obviously the issue of solar power remains a big one in the state. Both FPL and JEA have not necessarily encouraged solar power, or certainly rooftop solar power.
Right. I mean, the rate that FPL pays, the better rate that they pay is not for lack of trying on FPL's part to get it reduced. I mean, that's JEA has a little bit more autonomy than the investor-owned utilities do in Florida. And so they essentially implemented a net metering program that all the private utilities wish that they could implement for the rest of Florida.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that we know that those companies have acknowledged that pushing back on solar is actually something that they work on, that they do.
Yeah. I mean, we saw that happen in real time.
Yeah. Well, Nate Monroe, great to catch up with you on JEA. Thanks so much for being here today.
Of course.
Up next, plastics versus the planet. We talk about how you can help celebrate the 54th Earth Day. Thanks, buddy.
If I could only reuse time, oh, I'd go back 100 years to a place where I could listen to the lullaby of the rivers, for now and then there will arise out of the water. Indian spirits to tell me how they got their names and sing a lullaby of the rivers. Aklawaha, it's a tough name. You can find a with the coochie. Apalachicola, Wakala, Wasis, Osilla. Hatchie kiss and me. I'd lock me chalk to Hatchie. He call a Hatchie and the Swanee are singing lullaby of the river.
Welcome back. We celebrate Earth Day every April 22nd, and for the record, that's Monday, but many events are held this weekend. To talk about it, I'm joined now by four people with deep roots in the environmental community. Anne-Marie Moquin, founder of Beaches Go Green. Hey, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Meredith Jesperson, development director for the St. John's Riverkeeper. Hey, Meredith.
Good morning.
Samantha Ryan, president of Sisters of the Sea. Hey, Sam.
Hey.
And Bob Patterson, singer-songwriter and organizer of the annual Lullaby of the Rivers Festival in Volano Beach. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Bob, we were just hearing your song about the Lullaby of the Rivers. And talk a little bit about your love of Florida's wild places. And how do you mark our progress in Florida in terms of protecting that legacy?
Well, I always kind of consider myself to be a spokesperson for the wild heart of Florida. And I've been here for more than 50 years, and I've seen the degradation of our environment. So it's kind of the stand I'm taking is just trying to make people aware of the great injustice that's being done to our environment.
And the Lullaby of the Rivers is a tribute to Florida's rivers, particularly the Apalachicola, the Itchituckney, the Ocklawaha, the Kissimmee. These are all names that were given to those water bodies by Native people. And this song is also an invitation for people to embrace kind of that approach to interacting with nature.
It is. We're really strong about experiential education. We really focus on children, because if we don't teach kids about the environment, they won't grow up wanting to protect it.
Mm-hmm. Anne-Marie, what sparked you to create Beaches Go Green and start your own environmental organization as opposed to joining one that already existed?
I was really driven by wildlife, and I have a passion for nature. And when I saw how our single-use, fast-paced, convenience-based lifestyle was impacting wildlife and nature in the farthest reaches of the globe, I had seen several documentaries. I travel quite extensively, and just seeing it firsthand made me want to open other people's eyes to it. And I started out just thinking, you know, if we could educate people, most people, if they know better, they want to do better. And that's what we're all about, education.
And so you do cleanups pretty regularly at the beach. And that's one of your focuses. The theme of this Earth Day is the planet versus plastics. And plastic pollution is a lot of what you see. I know, I mean, anytime you go to the beach, there's trash to be picked up. A lot of it's plastic.
Absolutely. We see a ton of plastic pollution.
And the numbers aren't great when it comes to plastics. So there's more than 380 million tons of plastics produced every year. There's more produced in the last 10 years than in the entire 20th century. And 500 billion plastic bags made last year, one a minute. Meredith, you do a lot of cleanups with the Riverkeeper. You have a couple scheduled around Earth Day as well. What role does that play, and what do you see in the world of plastics, single-use plastics especially?
So we just did a cleanup yesterday, actually, at a small park in Mandarin, and it was amazing how many just Gatorade bottles, especially the caps, are left behind. People don't think about it. They just toss it, or they think it's in their car, and it flies out when they drive. And those are what easily get into our waterway. And we even had a gender reveal party, apparently, that happened at the park. And the metal and plastic confetti that was all over the field that people just left behind and didn't even think about that their one moment of joy is this lasting impact on our environment.
Caps are, I would say, the new cigarette butts. You know, there's not as much smoking as there used to be. And that used to be, and it still is a problem at the beach, but man, those caps are everywhere, Sam.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I saw a statistic that there are 100 billion plastic bottles sold last year just in the United States. That's 300 bottles a person. So, you know, finding a way to not use, to consume at that level, Bob, is a big part of, you know, preventing those, that type of pollution.
Yeah, it's really difficult for us, right? We're putting on a festival where obviously there's going to be food and vendors and that kind of thing. So we insist that people use paper-based products. There's no water bottles allowed. We have water stations where people can fill their own jugs. Even the our spoons and forks are actually from recycled wood, that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, but you really have to kind of be aggressive about that. And it's interesting to implement like a no water bottle policy because it's so hard. I mean, you know, from, you know, doing events, Beaches Go Green will be at, you know, the Donna Marathon and helping to clean up and make sure that waste doesn't just get thrown around. But people are in a hurry. They want something convenient and it's really hard to dissuade them from just grabbing a water bottle.
Absolutely. But when we educate them about the harmful chemicals in plastic that leaches into our food and drink, we can encourage them to choose reusable and drink out of glass or metal bottles. It's way more healthful for them personally, and it's better for the environment as well.
It's getting a little bit easier. I mean, there are a lot of places now that have water bottle filling stations.
Mm-hmm.
And, absolutely, you know, it does make it easier. But Meredith, what does your organization do to try to counter the narrative of just, you know, plastic consumption?
So one thing that's interesting that we are really partnering with businesses that use a high level of plastics to get them to reduce the number. For instance, with TPC Sawgrass, they used to put water bottles in every foursomes golf cart. And we worked with them starting last year that they don't do that anymore. They get reusable water bottles instead. And they put filling stations throughout the course. And they went through an insane number of water bottles every year. So for them, you know, it's also a cost measure to not put water bottles in every car. And then it's also a great environmental impact. So working at the source with people who are, you know, high consumption and changing the habits is really helping.
It's not just plastic waste too. Samantha, I mean, one thing that people don't realize is that for every bottle of water, it takes 6 bottles of water to make that product. I mean, it's resource intensive, even if you're not just talking about plastic waste. So your group spends a lot of time in the water.
We do. Sisters of the Sea started in 1997 with the mission of friendship, wave knowledge, and beach improvement. We simply wanted to show everyone that anytime you are at the beach, you can take time to pick up garbage. It doesn't have to be fancy. It doesn't have to be a huge cleanup, but leave it better than you found it.
And you do that pretty regularly. You have surf lessons that, you know, also are about giving back to the community, teaching people to surf who maybe have been through a cancer treatment.
Well, certainly. We do. We give back in a lot of ways. We've been giving to the breast cancer cause for over 26 years, but it's twofold. On the first Sunday of the month on the north side of the Jacks Beach Pier, 8 to 10 in the morning, we all gather to surf and clean up the beach. So we have a monthly beach cleanup and a surf session, and we'll help others in the water learn how to surf, or we'll just all surf together. It's women in the water. It's a lot of fun. And then we also have an event June 8th called Sisters and Survivors, a Day of Fun in the Sun, where we give free surf lessons to cancer survivors. And it's women working with women. It's 2 volunteers per person in the water for safety. And we partner with Saltwater Cowgirls. And it's truly a day of magic. We get these ladies standing, and it's really about celebration and having fun.
Most everybody get up on the board?
They do.
Yeah.
It's impressive. I love it.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the 54th annual Earth Day with a group of environmentalists, all of whom have some events surrounding the holiday. We also have a call. Jody from Jacksonville. Good morning.
Welcome to First Coast Connect. Good morning. Great show. Thank you so much for taking my call. And thanks for talking about our Mother Earth. If you watch the documentary Seaspiracy at seaspiracy.org, you will find out that 50% of the plastic in our oceans is from the fishing nets. So, and I, you know, fish is loaded with dioxin, mercury, plastic, and they also are sentient beings. So just by being vegan, you can dramatically reduce our plastic and carbon footprint. And fruits and vegetables from our farmer's market, you can eat them without any plastic, and some of them you can also eat them raw. So please consider going vegan for the Earth Day. It's great for our health, kind to the animals, and great for our environment. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jody. Certainly, you know, one of the main impacts on the environment is, you know, meat-based consumption. I mean, that is separate from plastics entirely, but it is it has its own serious footprint. How do you suggest people reduce their consumption of plastics? You know, are there strategies in terms of like how we buy things, other than, you know, just as Bob was saying, I mean, there's certain products that feed right to that, like a more disposable fork, not mm-hmm. a plastic fork. But what do you suggest, Anne, when people are trying to like clean up their act?
Absolutely. So one of the easiest things that people can do is to buy in bulk and think reusable. So you can have your own reusable containers. You can buy in bulk, which is typically more cost effective. And then you can make your own small serving sizes when you're packing a lunch or bringing a snack. Those kinds of things, choosing reusable over single use is something we promote really heavily. And that is a great way to reduce your plastic footprint. Avoid those impulse buys from like the dollar store or the areas at Target that, you know, just seem irresistible. A lot of those things aren't intended to last. And another big impact that we talk with a lot of our teenagers and our club members about is fast fashion. So the fashion industry has become a major polluter and actually is the second most polluting industry behind the oil and gas industry. So we encourage people to buy higher quality items that are more sustainable, repeat outfits and wearing, repair over, you know, throwing away. So there are so many ways you can do something that works for you. You don't have to go all or nothing. Like they say, we need a lot of people being more eco-friendly and perfectly than a perfect environmentalist or eco-friendly person.
I think a lot of people think that fast fashion or even used clothing has a home. You know, if they're not going to use it, they'll take it to the Goodwill or they'll take it to a consignment store and somebody will end up using it or wearing it. But that's really often not the case.
No, the majority, I don't have the statistic handy, but there's a majority of any of the clothing that we donate that ends up landfilled. And a lot of it is shipped overseas and there are people who resell it and then it ends up landfilled in countries that are even less capable of handling the waste, which unfortunately happens not just with our clothing, but a lot of our other waste where we ship it overseas and it's polluting the other side of the planet.
Meredith, we talk about single-use plastics, but I think a great frustration for a lot of us is not single-use plastics that don't have any lifespan. So you'll be buying, you know, a large plastic, I don't know, a vacuum or something that is going to last on this planet forever, and it lasts just a very short time before it breaks and needs to be replaced. Is there anything being done at those, like, you know, to try to persuade a more sustainable, longer lasting product line, or is that just cutting into profits of companies?
I think there's been some action on that, especially from large companies where they're starting to realize that people really care about what they're doing to the environment. So cause marketing is becoming a big player where, you know, companies are realizing if we say that we are sustainable and can prove why our products are better for the environment, that people want to support those companies. And I think the more that we get out there as consumers and show that that's important to us, the more companies will realize that it's actually going to be better for their bottom line. That yes, people may not be buying as many products right now, but long term, they'll be more loyal to the companies that they feel like are supporting the environment.
Is there anything that individuals can do on that level to make that known or to appeal to, you know, either their lawmakers or companies, mm-hmm. manufacturers?
Yeah, I think, you know, your dollar speaks. So before you buy a product, investigate the company and see if they align with your values when it comes to environmental sustainability. And, you know, if you support those companies, then eventually in mass, there's enough of consumers across the world that it's going to make a difference in pockets. And they're going to see that we care about the environment and we care about companies that feel the same.
And I would guess, Bob, that something like Consumer Reports, which has been around a long time, does those sort of evaluations. And they also prioritize, you know, low waste, lower, you know, impact, environmentally friendly products. You know, so there are ways to buy a little smarter.
There are, but you know, the challenge, the whole for the whole environmental issues, we can find most everybody will agree with everything that we're saying, but the issue is to actually get them to move. So that's the value of organizations like that we all represent here is if we can get more boots on the ground, setting examples, and especially getting the kids. We've got to have a new generation of people coming up with a different level of consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where our hope is.
And your festival, which is a two-day festival in Volano Beach, Lullaby of the Rivers, it actually, I mean, there is an admission fee, but if you're 15 or younger, you get in free. So you're really appealing to the youth of the area.
It is. And same for senior citizens. It's like $5. Yeah.
But what else can people expect when they come to the festival?
Well, there's a lot of really, it's a wonderful musical lineup, for one thing. Music is the great attractor. So we have a great lineup of stuff, including we have the legendary Bill Wharton Sauce Boss, who actually cooks gumbo while he does his performance on stage.
He's a fun show.
It's really a fun show. The audience comes up, they get to stir the gumbo, and when it's done, we have what's called a tasting tent, where people have environmentally resourced foods, and people come in and they can have samples of it. And then on Sunday, during Bill Wharton's show, everybody gets to sample the gumbo. It's a lot of fun.
He makes it while he performs, and then everybody gets a dish of it.
Yes, it's a beautiful show.
We have a call, Carolina. Good morning. Welcome to First Coast Connect. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Love your show. I just wanted to mention we recently had a pre-wedding party that was pretty large, and I wanted everything to be environmentally friendly. I was able to get in bulk some agave cups and cutlery, and we used bamboo napkins and dishes that were beautiful. But everything, I felt guiltless because I was able to buy these things in bulk and just be able to, if they were going to be thrown out, I knew that they were going to go into the environment and actually create some compost that was going to be helpful for the environment. Even the wrapping was compostable. So.
Wow.
Just to mention, a lot of restaurants could use things like that. I usually go for the cartons instead of the plastic containers, or just take it in, just a little foil wrapper instead of getting plastic wrapped in my food. So thank you. I really appreciate the call.
Thanks, Carolina. I appreciate your comments. And I want to ask you about that. Is it Anne-Marie?
Anne-Marie. Yes,
okay.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie, you talk about buying in bulk. Are there places that particularly sell in bulk? I mean, I know that we can all buy bigger quantities of something, but are there places when you're looking to like refill your laundry detergent or get your shampoo? Like, are there places around that people can go and get that quantity and fill their own containers?
Two come to mind. We have Eco Eclectic, which has a refilling section of their store in Jacks Beach. And then there's the St. Augustine Refillery also. And those would be more like personal care or laundry detergent type things. I mean, a lot of grocery stores or even some of the big box stores have the bulk solutions for buying, to be able to save and prepackage.
Yeah, it seems like there was a period where there was more bulk stuff available, and it's sort of dwindled again. Meredith, I don't know. Is that just a perception? It seems
harder
to find.
Yeah, I feel like you're accurate. There was a trend for a while where you could go into different places and buy in bulk, and that seems to have gone away. I know when it comes to food, you have a lot of the organic grocery stores now where you can buy in bulk. I know locally the Farmery has a great bulk selection of grains that you can go in and pick, and spices. So it's a matter of looking locally and doing some footwork before you restock your house.
I think COVID might have been a setback for some of that stuff too, because you're sort of like in a shared container.
Absolutely.
So what do you think, do you recommend, Meredith, when it comes to working on the kind of recycling that we do? I mean, I think very little of the plastics that we use, maybe as much as 95%, does not get recycled. And there's, I think, a misunderstanding. People believe that it is recyclable because it has a recycle symbol on it. That doesn't necessarily translate into reality, though.
Exactly. And a lot of it depends on where you live as well. Different communities, especially throughout the listening area, have different recycling programs. And some are really excellent and do sort materials perfectly. Others do not. And so I don't want to, say who does what, but you really have to be conscious of where you live. It might be worth taking your recyclables to a center directly and not having them picked up curbside if you feel like it would make a greater impact. So making sure that you as the consumer is the responsible one and you take that effort and not put it in the hands of others if you want your materials recycled appropriately.
It does seem, though, that there's, at some level this has to happen, Bob, on a larger scale as opposed to just individuals. Some of the change should be structural. regulatory? I know that there's some communities that have looked at, you know, requiring that the end use be actually recycled as opposed to leaving that to the consumer, you know, kind of putting more onus on manufacturers.
Yes, I've been seeing that too, but it's sort of, it's got a long way to go in my opinion. Yeah.
Before that takes root?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a political matter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it always is, because it's always about dollars and cents.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you have any suggestions when it comes to that kind of, you know, advocacy up, like trying to manage up in the community as opposed to just encouraging people and even like-minded people to participate in something that they believe in? But how do they kind of push that upwards?
Yeah, that's a challenging question. I would like to have that magic answer, because I'm sure I would receive many accolades if I could come up with that.
Yeah. Sam, how do you communicate? How do you connect with the community? You've talking about sort of building a stable of people to kind of expand.
Well, we're on the side of where we just look at what we can do individually. Small steps create big change if many people do that. So it might not seem like much to use a reusable water bottle or to bring your own bags to the grocery store or to even bring a takeout container, like a glass container, out to eat so you can put your leftovers in it. Anne Marie has certainly taught me so much with all of that. And we're more focusing on the individual. Small steps can create big change if we do it together, and it just becomes habit and we just do it over and over again. And if you just do those three things alone, if you imagine that, that's a lot of change.
And Sam, I know you're working with the Beaches Go Green for their Earth Day event. Will you just tell us, Anne Marie, what the event is?
Absolutely.
Because there's two of them, right?
There's actually four locations. So on Saturday, April 20th at 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we are having community cleanups for Earth Day. We have four locations. We have Atlantic Beach, Beaches Town Center. We have Jack's Beach next to the pier. We have Meikler Beach in Ponte Vedra, and we have Butler Beach, Anastasia Island. And all those locations, you can look for the Beaches Go Green tent. Anyone can come and sign in, and we will provide you cleanup supplies, reusable cleanup supplies that we wash and reuse, so not to create more waste. We try to keep it fun. We have local businesses that donate food for our volunteers and prizes, and we try to keep it fun and light. It's a great opportunity for students to gain service hours, and it's for all ages. Anyone can participate.
Yeah. And you quantify it as well. So that'll be fascinating to add all four cleanups together to see what impact Beaches Go Green made.
And the Riverkeeper, Meredith?
So we are not hosting our own event this year. We're in the middle of our month-long Great St. John's River cleanup. So we are promoting cleanups happening throughout our watershed. So this weekend, there are cleanups in Duval County, St. John's County, Seminole, Orange, Volusia, St. John's. Everywhere you look, there's going to be cleanups. So we are collectively counting how much trash within a month we collect. It's our second year doing this.
Well, you can find links to all of these events at WJCT.org. Anne Marie Moquin, Meredith Jesperson, Bob Patterson, Sam Ryan, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a minute with a triple threat performer who tackles more than 9 roles at once.
Amelia Island celebrates Wild Amelia Nature Festival on May 18th at Main Beach Park. Experience eco tours and exhibits, live animals, kids activities, food trucks, live music, and more. More info at ameliaisland.com/wildamelia.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
Join the World Affairs Council of Jacksonville and WJCT Public Media for a screening of 20 Days in Mariupol, the 2024 Best Documentary Feature Film Academy Award winner, on Thursday, April 18th, 6:30 p.m. at the WJCT Studios. Eurasia expert J.P. Natkin will provide context for the film. Reservations at wjct.org/events.
Thank you. When my son turned 18, he started showing signs of a psychosis disorder, and in his 20th year had his second major psychotic break. So we have been trying to get him the help he needs.
But what happens if he rejects that help? The ethical dilemma of involuntary commitment and the difficult choice families face. I'm Anthony Brooks. That's on the next On Point.
Today at 11, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Our retirement series continues with a highly requested topic, Medicare. And it's no wonder, it's complicated. Seniors face a tangled web of parts and plans, and if you don't enroll on time, you could get a penalty for life. Answering your questions about healthcare as a senior, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, I am joined now by Jason Woods, Jacksonville's native son. He is bringing his one-man performance to town, the near disaster of Jasper and Casper. Hey, welcome, Jason. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's really a delight.
So the music we just heard was your original orchestral composition,
mm-hmm.
but you wear a lot of hats, creatively speaking.
That's the rumor.
Yeah. Tell us all that you do. I mean, you direct, you're a composer, you act.
You're telling me all I do. You're right. You're right.
But there's more.
Compose music, do some scenic design, working on my first short film, have a feature film written. I create.
You do.
I create. That's what I do. But I don't do it alone. It sounds like I do it alone, but I have a lot of people that help me.
You have a lot of people that help you. But in this production that you're bringing to Atlantic Beach, you actually do it all.
I don't run the technical components. Bryce Cofield, my good friend, does that. But I'm on stage for 90 minutes telling the whole story with my music underneath it. Yes.
How many characters do you perform?
In The Near Disaster of Jasper and Casper, there are 9. And in A Christmas Carol, which I've talked about before in Jacksonville, there's about 20. But in Jasper and Casper, these are all my creations. Obviously, I didn't create the characters in A Christmas Carol. Charles Dickens did that.
Yes.
So.
But this is your own creation.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the story of Jasper and Casper. They're brothers?
They are. Well, Jasper is the adopted brother of Casper. Jasper is just under 20, and there's nothing really remarkable about him, but he wants to find his real family, so he goes on a search, and his adopted brother, Casper, who is ever eager to find a new audience of admirers, because he thinks himself the greatest actor in the world, happily accompanies him. Casper is full of malapropisms, and he meets people and says, allow me to reproduce myself. Casper is my name, and you would do well to dismember it. If you had seen me act upon a stage, you would look to your eyes, for they would stream tears. You would tend your hands, for they would ache from much applause clapping, and all the skin on your body would bump the goose.
Bump the goose. That's excellent.
So that's Casper.
That's Casper.
That's him in a nutshell.
A little full of himself.
That's him in a nutshell. Hey, everybody's smiling and nodding.
Yeah. Our production booth there loves you. So.
Oh, they're good people.
They are good people. So on this adventure, they encounter all kinds of other characters also played by you.
Correct. Yes.
Like?
There's a witch. Her name is Winifred Isabel Titania Charlotte Higgins. My initials spell witch. Can you believe my mother almost named me Brenda?
Very good.
Right. And of course, there's Festwick Oswald Popinjay, the Queen's messenger.
Huh?
His initials spell FOP, but we don't really say that in the show. We just let, and there's one person in about 3 years who's actually figured that
out. Noticed that on their own?
Yes. I'm not going to do him, but there's a Scottish thug named Cadmus Hexamus.
Oh.
And he's trouble. And he warns Jasper about the pasture of the deadly cows.
The pasture of the deadly cows.
I will do a little bit. He warns him, you better beware of the pasture of the deadly cows. I'm sorry, pasture of the deadly cows? Pasture of the deadly cows. Pasture of the deadly cows. That's what I said. Deadly cows. So people get a kick out of the cows.
There's also a dragon.
There is a dragon. Yeah. Yes. Yes. I play a dragon in the show.
Is it a scary dragon or like a friendly Puff the Magic type dragon?
No, not a Puff. It's a magical dragon that we're not sure about him at first. He's mysterious at first. There's a rumor that he can disappear, and he is articulate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, this show comes. It's actually going to be 3 performances over 3 months. Is that right?
We have
kind of an extended residency.
We have a show on April 25th. In Atlantic Beach, and we have future dates set right now, and I've performed it in a few other places, and we have even more that we hope to do in the future. So there's ample opportunities coming up to see the show locally.
Gotcha. And so how can people find tickets, and do they need to get them in advance?
Yes, we're not selling tickets at the door. We're only selling online, and you can get them at my website, which is jasonwoodsproductions.com. If you Google Jason Woods or Productions, you'll definitely find it. It's quite easy. I'm afraid the ticket link is kind of an alphabet soup of letters and numbers.
Okay. Well, they can find it at your website. I mean, you have been a acclaimed actor. You won, I'm trying to remember the name of the acting award that you won a couple of years back, but it was a solo performance award.
Yeah. I was really fortunate and surprised to win that at the United Solo International Theater Festival.
Congrats for that. I mean, you do off-Broadway work. Is it difficult to be working, putting on the kind of productions you are when you're just sort of down the street from these multi-million dollar extravaganzas?
Well, I made my peace with that before I went there. And I've also been there as a patron before, as an audience member. And it was actually just a thrill, mm-hmm. man. I was just standing on the street some days with a silly grin on my face, just saying, I'm in New York playing characters that I want to play, that I created.
Well, Jason Woods, we look forward to seeing you April 25th at your performance. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And that's our program. Join us again tomorrow when we talk about how you can make the leap from advocacy to activism. I'm Ann Schindler. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.